I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Mike Lubick of the New York Daily News and SportsOnEarth.com.
And I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press. This is the Sports Reporters Podcast, our Friday edition. We do the show every Friday and Monday, and we're glad to have you joining us. Friday and Monday allows us to set up football games on the weekend and then talk about how right or wrong we were on them on the Monday morning. No difficulty setting up what is one of the biggest games of the week. This is the biggest one, but we're at the time of year where, at least in the NFC and in the AFC, there's a lot of teams trying to vie for the last spots. But top spots in play are rare. Falcons and Saints is going to be a fascinating showdown of two teams that, honest to God, depending on when you checked in the season, you might have thought, A, there's no way this team doesn't go to the Super Bowl, or B, there's no way this team does go to the Super Bowl, depending on what week you happen to watch them play. Now both of them are cresting, and they're playing each other here with huge playoff implications. What do we think about this game?
Bobby, when you watch the Falcons, and as Bob and I know, Mitch, and I think you've learned over time, they do have a Boston College man, a quarterback, and you can never go wrong with a Boston College man. But Bob, when you watch them play at their best, the Falcons, do you wonder how they aren't still the absolute class of the NFC? And I know there was a hangover, and they didn't just lose a Super Bowl. They had the toughest Super Bowl loss of all time, one of the toughest Game 7 World Series NBA Finals losses I have ever seen in professional sports in this country. But then when you see them operating at a high level, they still look like a team that could go back to the big game and crack this streak of teams that the losing team hasn't been back since the Buffalo Bills.
Well, the names are there. The weaponry is there. Julio Jones is one of the handful of great receivers in the game. Ryan is coming off an MVP season. He still is capable of putting up big games. There was something missing, obviously, in the beginning, and we speculated about the hangover thing and how we've found that the Seahawks maybe have never recovered from their disastrous experience in the Super Bowl, and this was the same thing was going to happen to the Falcons, blah, 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 blah. But they seem to have found their way back into the mix here. What fascinates me about this game is what happened when they only played 2 weeks ago, in which Sean Payton was caught making a choking gesture.
Yeah,
and boy, that's over the line in this. That kind of personal response to things at that level is rare. In my experience, I don't remember too many times a coach would get involved. Players, of course, go off the rails, but a coach to do that and one who's reasonably well respected. Wow. The other thing about that game that I'll just throw out there is the Saints lost Alvin Kamara quite early, and they got him back. And Falcons are very susceptible to to good running attacks. They're giving up a very bad over 4 yards a carry as a defensive line. So that's something to keep in mind in this game.
I meant what I said before about it all depends on when you take a look at these teams. I watched that entire game. Don't ask me why.
Yeah,
between Atlanta and Tampa Bay. Now Tampa Bay's then also ran this season. And Atlanta struggled right to the end of that game. And if Tampa Bay doesn't make some dumb mistakes, they end up losing that game. And wait, Jameis Winston led the Bucs through the celebrated Atlanta defense. I mean, you're not going to a Super Bowl without a good defense pretty easily. So I just don't know about the Atlanta Falcons. I just don't know. I do think that, you know, Mike, we've talked about this a lot. Where do you play makes a big difference these days on these kind of games. And New Orleans is very, very good in New Orleans. And they obviously are not happy with a Drew Brees prick ending the previous game. But I don't think I've ever seen a team be this deep into the season and still be as much of a mystery to me that had been in the Super Bowl before in the previous year as the Atlanta Falcons.
No, but Mitch, do you not agree? And we have celebrated so far. We have celebrated so far the, shall we call it, the diversity in the NFC this year. But to me, the Saints are such an intriguing team. They have been intriguing since, Mitch, I think we might have, I might have written them off after they lost their first couple of games.
Right.
And then they got rolling. And they got rolling in a way that in the modern NFL is sort of unusual. They're sending two running backs to the Pro Bowl this year. They have a quarterback who thinks this might very well be his last rodeo. They have a coach who knows how to do this. And to me, of all the teams that I thought might go to the Super Bowl, I don't know what you guys think. Of all the teams from the NFC that I thought might go to the Super Bowl this year, I did not think the New Orleans Saints were one of them back in September.
Nor did I. But the way it's shaping up, they absolutely are in the mix. They absolutely have to be taken seriously. In a year when, as we'll state for the 10 millionth time, the NFC is wide open. There is, I mean, you might, I'm not sold that the Eagles are invincible. We know
well,
the Vikings
not now.
They've been having a fine season. But now Wentz is out. And but Foles did, you know, Foles is certainly a high quality backup. Anyway, no reason to think that I agree with you, Mike, to think that the Saints aren't in this legitimate championship mix.
And when you look at this weekend's games, Mitch and Bob, when you look at this, obviously we get, I'm not saying it's the Patriots versus the Steelers, but right now in the NFC, this feels like that kind of game. But the other game that captures my eye, and there may be two teams going completely in the wrong direction. And by the way, Mitch, if this is a Super Bowl hangover for the Seahawks, it's the longest hangover in the history of hangovers, okay? Because it's now lasted years. They get the Cowboys in Texas on Sunday, and the Cowboys are still kind of hanging around on the fringes of the playoff deal, and they get Ezekiel Elliott back.
Well, that's a huge thing that they get Ezekiel Elliott back, and I'm very motivated. Obviously, Ezekiel Elliott, if you looked at his press conference, he's sick of talking about the suspension, just wants to play football. They're clearly a better team when they have him, and I don't even know who the Seahawks are anymore. I mean, this is, you know, on the one hand, you have Russell Wilson, who's a potential MVP candidate this year. That's how good a season he's had. On the other hand, they're dropping games and collapsing at times that they don't even look like a Pete Carroll team. So you know, December was supposed to be when they normally turn everything on, right? That's their
Mitch,
MO.
Mitch, the 12th
right?
man, when they were getting thrown down a flight of stairs last Sunday, where was the 12th man in Seattle?
Yeah.
Well you know, let's be honest. I mean, isn't it easy to trace this demise at the present time to the injury thing? And the fact is that I often get tired in any sport of hearing about, well, injuries are part of the game. You got to suck it up. Well, there comes a point at when you can't. There's no next man coming up that's going to be close. When you don't have Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, Cliff Averill, with KJ Wright, and Bobby Wagner's already as hurt, you know, you're not going to be the same defense. And last week, Gurley ran all over them. And now Elliott's here prepared to do the same. What's the over-under on rushing yardage for the Cowboys this week is a question I think could be asked.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is – it's interesting because you have teams like the Lions, the Cowboys – the Seahawks to some degree, no longer the Packers, which, you know, not surprisingly, thanks Aaron Rodgers, you didn't come back to save the season, but you're not going to play the rest of it either. And they think that they can make it. And so you got some motivated, what I still believe will be also Rams when this thing is all said and done. And then you have the NFC South, which just has to keep playing itself, you know, and Carolina, yep. New Orleans and Atlanta all in that mix there. And I do think we're probably going to end up with, best bet right now, the way the Seahawks are going, is we're probably going to end up with two wild card teams coming from that division. Might have three teams from that division making the playoffs because unless Dallas does something, you know, the tiebreakers are ridiculous. The Lions need like 14,000 things to happen, and so does Dallas. So, but Dallas, you know, at Dallas with a slumping Seattle team, them at 9-6 is going to make for an interesting final week of the season.
All right, let's talk about the wild card possibilities. And just for the sake of you know, conversation, let's assume that it's going to be either the Saints or the Panthers, okay?
Yeah.
If the Falcons get to 10-5, Mitch, I think they're going to make it, don't you? If they win this game again.
They have to get to 11-5. But yeah, because they hold a lot of tiebreakers at 10-5 with the teams that are that they're up against.
The Lions and the Cowboys both end up at 10-6. Okay. I don't think that when I see what happened to the Seahawks last Sunday, I can't, as I often say about Ryan, some people cannot be rehabilitated. You know what I'm saying, Mitch? It's a fact of life, but I don't see the Seahawks picking themselves up, dusting themselves off and going on to the playoffs. No. So we're talking about a group that includes Cowboys, Lions, Falcons, or Saints, Panthers. It's again, after such a moribund season so often in the NFL, we get a lot of fun the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah. I think so, Mike. I think, and I'm saying for weeks that I'm looking forward to the NFC playoffs matchups and endless possibilities and intriguing ones and no definitive answers, and which is, you know, kind of cool going into the playoffs, you know, as opposed to there's certain things we expect and we'll be surprised if they don't materialize in the AFC. There aren't so many things that we can expect, and therefore we're just sitting up and just back and taking it all in and enjoying whatever happens in the NFC.
Well, by the way, don't knock off the AFC's. You know, that's not a done deal yet either.
Oh, there's
and
one
there
more team.
Are, you know, we're not giving it the kind of credence that we're giving the NFC, because we all kind of believe it's going to be New England, Pittsburgh anyhow. So everybody else is just sort of the Washington Wizards, the Washington Generals, you know, playing for everybody else. Although there have been some seasons that the Wizards would have qualified too. But, you know, look at Tennessee, look at Jacksonville.
Stop right there. That's the right mystery guest of the entire NFL season.
Yeah.
Because outside of the Bortles household in Jacksonville, Florida, how many people know at what a high level Blake Bortles, after such a sketchy beginning to the season, has played at over the last several weeks?
Yep.
Yeah. No, that is exactly right. And they are the flavor of the moment. And I am, for one, I'm taking them seriously. The defense is, you can't argue with the defense. And you're right. When Bortles has upped his game the last 3 weeks, he's put up really good numbers. He's played really well. Mike, I know you've got to love the idea that whatever the direct causality is, you cannot. Don't we both agree that Tom Coughlin's presence has got something to do with something?
Oh, 100%. It's the old line. It was originally the great Bill Russell's line about his Oakland friend Joe Morgan. Isn't it funny how good teams seem to follow Joe Morgan around? Okay, people forget sometimes how quickly the second year Tom Coughlin had the expansion Jacksonville Jaguars in the AFC Championship game
in New England. I remember it. Yep.
And they have the too. If you take a point away, they have the largest differential points for versus points against in the NFL.
It's crazy, Mitch.
The Rams on the other side are close to them, and that includes vaulted New England, who they're far, far ahead of, and New England is still interesting this week, both from you know the game that they've got against Buffalo and the interesting sort of side story about Jimmy Garoppolo, finding success in, of all places, San Francisco, and reminding people in New England that they are literally one Tom Brady injury away from absolute decimation. And I know there's been some talk about that, Bobby, in Boston this week.
Well, there sure has, because the name Garoppolo has popped up as a kind of collateral damage in this little fascinating thing going on with Tom Brady and his guru trainer, Alex Guerrero, and the fact that Bill Belichick, after years of toleration of having this guy allowed on the plane, on the sideline, having privileges that would make him an equivalent of an assistant coach or a trainer, at some point a couple of weeks ago, quietly had this revoked, and now it's come to light, and people are wondering about a lot of things, and the fact that Brady and Belichick, their personal relationship, which no one was ever sure exactly what it was in the first place, it's definitely not kumbaya right now, and as a result of this business, and what was the tipping point for Belichick. Why did he make this decision after several years of allowing it? Well, was it because there was an increasing number of Brady's teammates who were also seeking the services of Alex Guerrero? More than likely, but we don't know for sure. So it's because Belichick has sidestepped it, Brady has sidestepped it, naturally, and it's fascinating. But I mentioned Garoppolo because my colleague and friend Dan Shaughnessy is not the only one, but today he came out with a big forum in the Boston Globe and stating categorically, with no attribution, but stating categorically that Belichick did not want to trade Garoppolo. That this has something to do with Brady's status as the surrogate son of Bob Kraft, and the loyalty to Brady there, and that the coach was overruled. Is that something if it's true?
Mitch,
let me explain something.
Wait, let me read from Dan Shaughnessy's column, because for people who don't understand this drama, this kind of sets the table. Rock and roll folklore holds that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles just as Svengali Dr. Eugene Landy took Brian Wilson away from the Beach Boys. And now here in Boston, we have faux doctor Alex Yoko Guerrero threatening the longstanding ties that bind the world champion Patriots. I exaggerate, of course. That's what we do here in the toy department. Still, it's a mistake to follow the lead of the formidable New England Patriots media cartel, where most everyone either works for the team or is afraid of the team, and insist that the presence of Tom Brady's guru Guerrero is no threat to break up the band at Gillette. We know that Brady and Belichick are not as close as they once were. We know that Brady has to be miffed that Guerrero is gone. We have a pretty fair sense that Belichick hates it when other Patriots players reject team training methods. So holy moly, there's a lot going on in Foxborough.
Well, yep, and here's the funny thing to me, Mike and Mitch, is that what is the dreaded word begins with a D in all of sports? Distraction. Yep. And this, obviously, at this important juncture of the season, things aren't settled for them. They're not in yet. They have to win out and assuming that Pittsburgh, who by the way have left at Texas and home against, oh yes, the Cleveland Browns. So they're going 13-3.
Yep.
All right. And the Patriots need to, so they got to win. I know they got the tiebreaker with them, but they don't want to lose that spot. And Buffalo, playing Buffalo. All right. They got business. Buffalo's playing for something. Buffalo is in the playoff mix in the AFC. So distraction. Who created the distraction? Why Belichick did by revoking the Guerrero privileges, which he is not, could he possibly be naive enough to think that once this surfaced, it wasn't going to be a big story and therefore was going to become an automatic, by definition, distraction, that if he had shut his mouth or he had, you know, sucked it up a little longer, I mean, he's created the distraction in my mind. Am I wrong?
Well, all right, but we all know Belichick who abhors distractions. So you have to think that something was going on that he could no longer tolerate, or that he thought was going to end up becoming a bigger distraction, or was a challenge to his power, because that's the only thing that he and Tom Brady can wrestle over, is who's really running the team, as often happens with a star and a star's coach. But two things on that. One, what are either one of them going to do? They're not going anywhere.
Okay? Where are they going?
Their bed. Tom Brady's staying there for the rest of his life, especially if he's the surrogate son of Bob Kraft. And Bill Belichick's not going anywhere. The bigger surprise to me, as someone who does not live in Boston, is the Jimmy Garoppolo thing. Because even if, I mean, Tom Brady knows he's the greatest of all time, despite what he may say, whatever humility, he knows he's already won the brass ring on that. And now he's just trying to push himself so far ahead that nobody will ever catch him. Was he honestly threatened by the fact that Jimmy Garoppolo was on the team?
Mitch, that's the question. And so we can both throw this to Bob, who lives there and is a patriotologist. Why now with Garoppolo? Did he think that next year he wouldn't be able to get a high second round draft choice from some bad football team? Why was it done now?
That's what we're asking, and we asked it at the time because part of it, does it tie into the idea of Brady's invulnerability? That they actually would buy into the idea that Brady is selling that, which Brady is selling that, you know, he won't get concussions because he's got a brain, you know, liquids or whatever the hell from Guerrero or whatever. I mean, they had the great. They knew that how good, or they did maybe not how they knew they had something pretty damn good in Garoppolo, and it was a perfect insurance policy in case anything were to happen. And now they're totally uncovered. Brian Hoyer is the backup. And, yeah, why now? That is the great question. And not to mention, by doing so, by giving only getting a second-round pick, yes, it's a second-round pick, not that far from where the first-round pick would be with the Patriots, right. But the fact is it's a second-round pick. No, these are very big, unanswered questions.
Mitch, you know how they always teams like to ask this question in sports, why not us, why not now?
Yeah.
My question is, why him and why now?
Really? It is a total mystery to me. I mean, do you think is it contemplatable, Bob, that Tom Brady's ego is actually sensitive enough to feel that keeping a guy like Jimmy Garoppolo on the roster is somehow undermining his promise that he's going to play till 45? And if Bob Kraft or whoever he had to go over the head of Bill Belichick to would just get rid of Jimmy Garoppolo, it would make Tom feel a whole lot better because
if could answer where I have no Tom is he's changing, he's evolving, he's turning into as Shaughnessy suggested later on in that column, he's Tom Cruise, he's just a couple of steps away from jumping up on the sofa defending Guru. Defending his guru, okay? And on the Oprah show.
No, he's getting weird, okay?
Yes, he is getting weird. And he's totally getting weird. I mean, this guy, let's people that are listening that still haven't fully grasped the extent of this relationship. Tom Brady, as recently as this week, declared that Guerrero is one of his closest friends. And, oh, by the way, he is the godfather to Tom Brady's son, Benjamin. That's how close they are. And so this is, it's uncomfortable. It has obviously been uncomfortable for everybody in the organization as it is evolved, and when it ensnares, if you will, if that's the proper verb, others on the team, a growing number of them on the team. Yes, something at some point Belichick said, I had enough, and risking whatever consequences that would mean, he weighed his options and decided that was his better course of action, obviously. And where Garoppolo fits into all this is we don't know for sure, but boy, isn't it fun to contemplate. Meanwhile, look what the guy's doing out there.
Oh, no, it's great. It's a football. Mitch, let me ask you this, because we have all covered the biggest stars in sports for all of our adult professional lives. There is an element of weirdness. Now, if we made a list over the last 25 years in America, who are the GOATs that we talk about? Okay, in no particular order, Michael/LeBron, Tiger Woods, and Tom Brady. And Michael, as legit as he was as a superstar, in the middle of one of the great careers in the history of American sports, goes off to play minor league baseball. We'll never probably know why he did it at the time. Tiger Woods had and has his own weirdness. The only one who hasn't gone a little bit nuts is LeBron.
Well, what happens is with all these guys that you've mentioned, the world becomes very insular. You know, they can't trust a lot of people. They can't go anywhere. They become Elvis. You know, Elvis renting amusement parks at 3 o'clock in the morning to have a regular party because he can't go out during the day. Anytime you become sort of isolated with a small group, you tend to overemphasize that group, i.e. the Elvis Mafia, or in this case, Tom Brady's particular hand-chosen trainer, and you start talking about him as if he's God. Is that weird, or is that just the life of a beyond scope celebrity? LeBron James's life is not normal either. You're about the only guy I can think of in recent history who seemed to somewhat remain, you know, with his feet on the ground and have that kind of fame was Derek Jeter. You saw him a lot more than I did, but you know,
but he wasn't as good at what he did. As famous as he was, Mitch, right. he wasn't one of the great baseball players of all time.
He was
I'm talking
in New
about
York.
Okay, my dear
Worldwide.
Friend, one of my writing heroes is William Goldman. Okay, and he once wrote, in addition to The Princess Bride and Butch Cassidy and the screenplay for All the President's Men, he wrote a great book about Hollywood called Adventures in the Screen Trade. I'm going to paraphrase. And he said, movie stars are exactly like the rest of us. They get up in the morning, they put on their clothes, they live their lives, they go to bed at night. He said, the only small difference is, in between, nobody ever says no to them. Okay? And what is interesting to me about this Brady Belichick trainer bullshit is this, and I want to ask you both about this. Is Belichick acting out with this trainer because he's pissed that he feels that he was forced to trade Jimmy Garoppolo?
Well, now you're taking two speculations, putting them together and saying,
I like it. Well, that's right. I can do the double speculation.
Yeah, you can,
a figure skating move. They'll name that after me. It'll be called the double Lupica.
The double Lupica. Well, in the double Lupica scenario, it makes perfect sense. But I want the caveat that I have no basis of fact for it whatsoever.
No, but interesting. We're proceeding on the assumption that there must be some foundation in what Danny wrote, that this trade was not done with Bill Belichick's total blessing. I don't think that's a wild leap of faith to take here, or is it?
No, I mean, it's just hard to imagine that he would want to jettison a good insurance policy. Yeah, at that point, we all wondered, and it seemed to be made in haste because they accepted they didn't accept, you know, how much on the dollar. They clearly didn't get 100% on the dollar, or how much they got, we don't know. In return for, as we see, what Garoppolo is becoming already, a second round pick, even if it is close to a late first round pick, is not enough. Let me just throw one more postscript here. As you were speaking about the weirdness factor, I was thinking that until the entrance of Guerrero into his life and becoming the head of dominating influence in his non-Giselle life, what struck me most impressive about Brady in this context is that he was able to live a remarkably normal, quote-unquote, life, in which he was not a hermit. He was out doing stuff, but still somehow was able to do it by putting up an invisible shield between him and the public, where he could acknowledge the public. He wasn't anti-paparazzi. Didn't have his picture taken strolling with his kids in the park and all that kind of stuff. He lived a normal life. It seemed.
You know what the difference was, Bob?
I said he compartmentalized himself brilliantly. Okay.
No, but you know what the difference
now.
Was. You know what the difference was? He was younger. And the one thing that Tom Brady is probably most frustrated at is that he cannot just stay at 31 years old. And all of this is about continuing to play beyond. That's all that's left for Tom Brady. He doesn't need any more rings. What's left for Tom Brady is to outlast everybody and prove a longevity in football, in a sport. When you said what you did a little earlier about liquids on his brain to protect against, you know, I just sat here and scratched my head. He's going, he's got liquids to protect against concussions. When you start thinking like that, he's taken on one force that ultimately he's going to lose to, and that is Father Time. But he can't stomach losing. And so if anything is making him a little dizzy, a little odd, a little less than the guy you're recalling from back in the days when he seemed perfectly normal, it's the fact that he's now 5, 10, 12 years older than you're recalling him, and his opponent is getting older.
Oh, he's the only one with liquids on the brain. Like,
All right, speaking of foods that are good for you, I'm going to make a shift here.
No, you did not just make that transition. You did?
I call that the double album, okay? Yours was the double Lupica. Mine lands on its skates. The holidays can be stressful, folks, but figuring out what's for dinner should never have to be stressful. So let's talk about Freshly. Freshly delivers fully cooked, prepared meals and bring them straight to your door. Pretty good thing to have in the holiday season when you don't want to go outside. You get to skip the shopping, the chopping, the cleanup. All you have to do is heat up these meals, and they're ready to eat in 3 minutes. The best part? Freshly's fresh, all-natural meals cost 25% less per meal than the average cost of takeout. And they're a whole lot better for you. And you'll never be stuck sitting around waiting for the food to arrive by the delivery guy who never shows up. Right now, Freshly is running a special offer. You can get 6 dinners cooked by their chefs for $20 off. To try Freshly out, you go to freshly.com/sportsreporters. You'll get a special meal then. To get $20 off your first week, that's 6 meals for just $39 plus free shipping. Do the math on that. You can barely eat at McDonald's for that. This offer is only valid for a limited time, so go to freshly.com/sportsreporters for $20 off and free shipping. Bob, you want to talk a little basketball?
Well, yes, we've got a big Christmas Day coming up, and the marquee game, unfortunately, has a little bit of a sheen taken off it because that would be, of course, the Cavaliers and the Warriors and Stephon Curry, who sustained that injury not a couple weeks ago, is not going to be playing. But it's funny how this has evolved. You know, back in the day, back in my youth, speaking of younger days, there was one Christmas game. Now, of course, this is a
it's a thing.
It's a crazy thing, and it's five of them. And starting off with the Sixers-Knicks, and then followed up by the Cavaliers-Warriors. Wizards-Celtics, Rockets at Thunder. Ooh, we'll get to that. And Timberwolves at Lakers. So we got two marquee games, really, if you want to go with the Rockets and the Thunder. And anyway, so that's what's going on there. And I think we want to pay some homage here as their record mounts. The Houston Rockets are sitting, as I speak, on this date, 25-5. And can there be any doubt, folks, that they are a very, very, very serious threat to the Western Conference supremacy of the Warriors.
I don't know what you guys think about this. I was very curious we had the same questions about Durant and Curry, and I had these questions about the Rockets. And whatever list we want to make of the alpha dogs in the NBA, Harden and Chris Paul are alpha dogs. And, you know, Paul is a wonderfully gifted point guard. He's extremely unselfish, but he's used to having the ball. Harden seems to have the ball more than anybody in the league, when the Rockets are going. So this was a laboratory experiment that I was very curious about. But so far it has worked out great. They are making it work. They have a deep, athletic roster. At this point in time, they are one half game better than the Golden State Warriors. And I was talking to Jeff Van Gundy about them, and he says he wasn't sure last year that the Rockets, for all the early speed they show, were built for the playoffs. He's convinced that they're built for the playoffs this time.
Mike, I bet you share with me a little glow that, you know, for D'Antoni.
Oh, he's one of the best guys. He's one of the nicest people I've ever come across in the NBA.
Yeah. And I rooted so hard for Phoenix to get it done that year. They had that one window open, and then, of course, the stupid suspension and Stoudemire and all that nonsense. And that was that. His ship is coming. I just, you know, when he got that job, I said, this is not possibly happening, isn't it? The greatest marriage made in basketball heaven apart time is D'Antoni and James Harden, right?
Yeah.
I mean, talk about, you know, as someone once said, I remember back in the day, Mike and Mitch, when Gus Williams was the hot flavor of the month in Seattle, and Mike's great, great friend, Paul Westfall, and my friend, Paul Westfall, said, Gus Williams doesn't have a green light. He has no lights. And that is the way it is with Harden. And yet, as you say, Mike, he and Paul have come to an accommodation.
You bet.
Well, the thing that most impresses me about James Harden is that he continues to get better. Like, you keep thinking every season, well, then, all right, he's at his best. And then I actually thought, you know, like Chris Paul coming there. Like, I always think about these superstar matchups. All right, is it a plus or is it a minus? Does the other guy have to take a chunk of the superstar that was there before in order for him to be as good? It seems that in a remarkable piece of alchemy here, they put Chris Paul on the same team as James Harden, and Harden got better. You know, and that's weird, you know, because you would just figure some part of it would be sharing. So I'm extremely impressed with him and extremely impressed with Paul. I mean, until they lost the other night, right? How many games did he set some record for a guy who first joins a team winning every single game when he first gets there? Usually there's a transition difficulty. And I love the fact that this is working so well. And meanwhile, then you look over the team. Aren't they playing on Christmas, Oklahoma City? Yep. And you see a whole different kind of chemistry issue going on there.
May I ask a question to my friend Mitch Albom and my friend Bob Ryan? Let's say we're choosing up sides for a really big game in the NBA. Let me throw this to Ryan. Do you think a team that had Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James? Oh, you could never get those three guys to.
Nah.
Oh, wait. Weren't they together once, Bob?
They sure were. And interesting how the decisions that were made there.
Oh.
And the first one was, we're going to pay Serge Ibaka, not James Harden, right? Am I wrong about that?
History books will be written about this in an AAU NBA, okay? Everybody's trying to get three guys like that. They had three guys like that.
But did they have three guys like that like they are now when they've been allowed to thrive in their other environments? Could they ever have been the players that they are now if they had stayed all on one team?
But why could it? Why can't listen? Steph Curry and Kevin Durant have made it work with other guys who are great in Golden State. Okay, and I'm not Draymond doesn't need the ball. I get that. Okay, Klay Thompson kind of does, and the idea that they made a determination, well, they made two determinations, as I remember. Bob, you can correct me on this. One, Sam Presti decided he couldn't pay all three, except somehow in the NBA, teams seem to be able to pay everybody as much as they want all the time. And they were wondering if the three of them could make it work. But the thing is, we never really got to see them try to grow together because they broke it up as quickly as they did.
Yeah, you're right. No, they did. And pain, you know, suffering for it. I mean, as we look at their 500 team right now.
Yep.
With this new conglomeration, which is not exactly clicking the way that they hoped it would, Westbrook, George, and Anthony. And what ifs? Hey, what ifs clutter the landscape of sport? And without, you know, we that's it. That's part of the deal.
Okay, I want to shift what ifs to what will be. And an NBA guru that you are, Bob, when they came out with the list of Hall of Fame nominees, especially the first time ones. Now they rolled the year back by a year, so
yeah,
you can go in after
3 years
4 years.
My
first thought was immediately, I'm going to ask Bob if you know who automatically gets in. I'm notoriously bad at this stuff because I never quite understand what each Hall of Fame in each sport is looking for. It always seems to me like to make the Baseball Hall of Fame, you have to do so much more than to get into, you know, for example, the Hockey Hall of Fame or whatever. And basketball also seems to have its own rules. So, Jason Kidd, Steve Nash, Ray Allen, Grant Hill, Chauncey Billups, and Rip Hamilton, the last three of which I watched most of their careers.
Yep.
Who's a shoe-in? Who's a question mark? Who doesn't belong there?
I think that in some order, Kidd, Nash, and Allen are going to go in without much opposition or much question. The only question will be who gets more of a priority among between those two point guards. And I think I would say Kidd, a more sustained career, a longer career. Yes, Nash had that one great run, which included and I must say, disputed back-to-back MVPs. You know, a lot
weren't
of people,
they both on the same team once?
The great, and then there was, yeah, way back, that in the Dallas days, yep, yeah. And of course, there's stuff, the good stories came out of that. Allen speaks, obviously, he is a symbol of the 3-point. He's the guy that created the world as much as anyone, the world we're living in now with this 3-point proficiency, and it's definitely going to, and it's got a signature moment too, which is that great shot that wins, that guarantees a championship. There you go. I think Grant Hill is worthy, and I would certainly advocate Grant Hill myself. And
let me stop you on Grant Hill for a second. Grant Hill's an interesting story because I think Grant Hill as the total basketball player, meaning you think about his college days, you think about his Olympics and all the rest of it, is much more sterling than his actual NBA career, which was interrupted for, you know, the better part of 3 or 4 years as he battled injuries. He only once went to the playoffs as far as maybe a conference final, and that was when he was playing with Phoenix, right? Not when he was with Detroit or Orlando. They were mostly first round eliminations with him. So he's like, but everybody loves Grant Hill. So who would ever want Grant Hill not to get some kind of accolade?
Well, you touch upon something, Mitch, is very important to understand, but people understand about this, and it's become a bone of major contention and frustration for some people as they look at the Hall of Fame. This is not an NBA Hall of Fame. This is the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, which for better or worse, and some people think for worse, as from the very beginning of its concept and its execution, has been devoted to the world of basketball, at which at the time of its creation back in the 50s, the NBA was not the most important part. The history of basketball then was about college, and the NBA was then not even 25 years old. The NBA came into being in 1946. And so it was originally enshrined to address college and amateur players. Now the NBA is the predominant factor. Jerry Colangelo has taken complete control of the mechanism and has created committees. And this thing transformed itself dramatically. So point being, would someone take into consideration, because it is an all-encompassing and his career, that Hill's college career, which was, he was one of the last great 4-year players. There weren't many, you know, yeah, as Grant Hill, as a major factor and giving him a vote. Were I one of those voters, Mitch, this time? Yes, I would, because I go back in spirit to that original concept of this league, of this organization, that it is not just the NBA Hall of Fame.
It's an interesting resume for Grant Hill. And again, Mitch is right. He's going to get in because people like him. Okay. If you look, you know, I mean, he had a Bill Walton like pro career, but was interrupted by injuries. He ends up playing all the years he plays. I don't think he averaged 20 points a game for like more than the last decade of his career. But before we move on from this discussion, and I don't care which one of them is the first among equals. Kidd and Nash are two of the greatest and most creative and most wonderful on the floor players in the history of the sport, particularly Jason Kidd. I talk about this all the time, Bob. When he really couldn't shoot anymore, he was an integral part of a Knicks team. The only Knicks team that's been successful in the last decade and a half was when they won 54 games in the Atlantic Division title with J.R. Smith and Carmelo Anthony. And Kidd's name is sort of forgotten. And there would be nights when he didn't score a point, or so it seemed. He is one of the most brilliant playmakers that this sport has ever seen or will ever see.
Also, when you talk about the great triple-double people, he's up there. And he was an all-encompassing, a 6'4", tough guy, a tough, fearless rebounder. And he made himself into a three-point shooter. To me, he's a, you know, an all-time great. Nash left us with images that are just priceless, wonderful. That and whoever went in and out more than Nash, and Nash brought that floater back, and which every high school kid is doing now. And but anyway, he has on his resume back-to-back MVPs. That's a tough one to ignore. But they're going in. It's just a question of and we won't know. It's not like baseball. We won't have a vote tally. Where it'll be a big thing. We'll just know that they get in.
All right, time for our parting shots, and Bob Ryan leads off.
All right, guys, I got a question for you. Do you know what UConn women's basketball was before Gino Auriemma showed up? Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say nothing, but it sure wasn't very much. Try one winning season in 10 years under three different coaches. And now 18 Final Fours and 11 national championships later, Gino Auriemma's current top-ranked team has presented him with his 1,000th career triumph. And yes, we must likewise congratulate Sylvia Hatchell, whose North Carolina Tar Heels presented her with her own 1,000th win the same night. But let's stick with Gino for a moment. Now, people say, well, he gets all the best players. Duh. Of course, recruiting matters. And not all the best, but certainly his fair share. A great subject would be just who was the greatest female Husky of them all. Diana Taurasi, Maya Moore, Breonna Stewart, or any one of a half dozen others. The point is that what Gino has created is almost unimaginable and should not be undersold. You know, it didn't have to happen there or anywhere, but it did, and it's not over.
In general, Pro Bowl selections are pretty statistical. Good numbers, good year, you make the team, high five. But this week, one Pro Bowl selection was more than numbers. It was the selection of Pittsburgh's Ryan Shazier, the fourth-year linebacker who suffered a horrific spinal cord injury earlier this month after a collision during Monday Night Football. His future is cloudy. While all the hosannas and prayers and well wishes and even the appearance of Shazier at last week's game against the New England Patriots made us feel better at the holiday season, the fact is, at the very best, this man has a huge challenge ahead. Forget about football. We're talking about life. It's a grim reminder of the risks the players take every snap in the NFL. And a reminder of previous tragedies like Mike Utley and Daryl Stingley, tragedies that, despite a similar narrative, did not stop young men from rushing to play professional football. It's a brutal, often barbaric game, and the fact that we love it doesn't change that. For men like Shazier, who make the conscious choice to play, a Pro Bowl nod is a precious thing. And Shazier says it was one of his two goals for the season. The other was a Super Bowl. That is now in someone else's hands. But as we contemplate the Ryan Shazier story, isn't everything?
Dick Enberg has died at the age of 82. He dies a year or so after retiring as one of the voices of the San Diego Padres because he had returned to his first love, which was always baseball. But you need to know something about someone I knew for most of my professional life. Dick Enberg was one of the great broadcasters of all time, with as much variety in his game as a five-tool basketball player. He was the voice of Super Bowls, and he did the first breakfast at Wimbledon with my dear friend Bud Collins. He did the Olympics. And before all that, he was UCLA basketball in the Angels. In addition to it all, he was a gent. And know something else about Enberg. If he only had worked with Al McGuire and Billy Packer on college basketball, one of the great three-man boosts ever in the history of sports broadcasting, at a time when college basketball was becoming a big deal in this country, that would have been enough to classify him as a giant of his profession forever. Oh, man, we lost a giant. Or as Dick would say, oh, my. Thank you for joining us on the Friday edition of the Sports Reporters. Have a Merry Christmas. We will be back with you on Tuesday, the day after Christmas, to put a bow. See what I did there? Around
Very
everything
nice.
That will.
Very nice.
That was good. That was professional broadcasting right there. Yeah, to put a bow around everything. Listen.
Words are your life, Michael.
Continue to grow with this podcast because this is exactly what you knew for years and years and years on Sunday morning. So wherever you get your podcast, not only go get it, leave comments about it, tell your friends about it, and just know this. We're having as much fun as we ever did. So for Mitch Albom and Bob Ryan, Merry Christmas, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.